Grade 5, Botany. This is the second part of what to teach in the botany lesson and the fourth lecture for botany altogether. So now we'll talk about the second block. Once you have worked in the first block with the principle of metamorphosis and brought to the children's attention here and there this upside-down quality of the human being and the relationship to the plant, then you have a greater degree of freedom in the second block. And some things that I would suggest can be taken up, and perhaps you're going to spend more or less time on them. It's the progression, the sort of evolutionary progression of plants. So now you can do that. Now you do it at the end rather than at the beginning. Looking at trees, or it might be you live in an area with near prairie, or a place where there are lots of shrubs. You know, it's not that you are fixed, that you have to do one or the other. You may want to examine fruits and berries. Perhaps you live in a part of Oregon that's rich in orchards, and the children know a lot about the fruits because they're always helping to harvest them, or go to fairs, which are around the fruit. Maybe you're in Gilroy, California, where it's all garlic. Definitely, definitely take that up. The first time I taught botany, the school was actually embedded in the fellowship community in Chestnut Ridge, New York, which in turn was in those days also the home of the Wilita production area. And my class and I actually started up a little medicinal herb garden. And we learned a lot about poisonous plants, many of which have an important role to play, like henbane, in work with medicine, and that are quite poisonous. Sometimes even touching them can affect somebody very deeply. And also a lot of plants that you hardly see outside of medieval museums or Shakespeare gardens. So that's no problem. If you're going to go in that direction, that's very good. And I also suggest work with, if not a whole bunch of insects, at least one or another insect that might be really characteristic of your area or that in which you have a particular interest. Now let's just look for a moment at this sort of evolutionary development. You want the children to at least become familiar with the differences between the fungus, the sponge, algae, moss, ferns, gymnosperms, monocotyledons, dicotyledons. So you take them on this progression. Now, even though you've already learned about the monocots and the dicots, they can come back to it now from a different direction, sort of from the earthbound perspective. And the way Steiner suggests it is that you look at these different plants as stages of a human life. So the fungus, which cannot touch the earth directly, which must, as it were, be carried in the arms, in the matrix of another plant, that's very, very much like the baby. And with each of these plants, we go a little bit more to touching the earth and to being able to have a full threefold quality of real roots, real stems, and leaves, and real flowers. And we can see how these earlier plants, the plants that appeared earlier on the earth, they are making little sketches as though they're knowing the way a baby, a young child, would sketch a grown-up as a round head and some sticks coming out of their body. They are trying to make themselves in the image of a flowering plant. And the mushrooms here are always fascinating because they take on colors, they take on forms very much like flowers. But of course, they're anything but. And the more a mushroom tends to look like a flowering plant, the more alluring its color and the more interesting its shape, the more likely it is that that can kill you. So it's sort of out of place. It should not be taking on these qualities, and it insists on doing that anyway. So you don't have to go into major Latin names, and you don't have to do a long, long study. 1 week, even 3 days on that progression of plants is good. It gives the children a good start. If they're fortunate enough to be going on to a Waldorf high school, they'll go into it much more deeply there, where they'll really sort of learn it in modern scientific terminology, but not yet. That isn't so completely necessary. And we did, in addition to our work with the sort of medicinal garden, we also work with the pharmacist at Wellita and with the people who were compounding some of the cosmetics as well. And we learned a lot about the iris plant and how the iris tuber, which is adept at thriving in dry soil, wet soil, in marshes, and almost in near desert conditions, how Rudolf Steiner realized that that tuber could probably be very helpful to human skin, which also has to go through a variety of climatological and atmospheric changes in our time with air conditioning and central heating. From hour to hour or minute to minute, our skin is going through many different areas of the earth. And how then a Dr. Schmidt developed these tubers into what today is called iris lotion, which is a very remarkable skin lotion. We saw the different ways in which these substances are processed. We saw the distillation process and learned about homeopathizing. Now, this was a very particular circumstance that we had, that we happened to be there in Wellita, which no longer produces anything in the United States, was producing quite a bit of its own products in those days. So that was quite an exciting adventure for us. And I'd say if you are interested in knowledgeable in the use of plant substances, not only in food, but also in medicine, botany can be a wonderful time to take that up. We looked at the life of trees living in the Northeast. We certainly have a great variety of trees to look at, and the spectacular autumn foliage. What's that all about? The sudden turning color, the tree's gesture of trying to be a big flower, if only it could, after being green so long. We looked at different kinds of barks. We tried to examine something of the roots that were exposed, the conifers, deciduous trees. So we worked on that for about a week as well, also looking particularly at apples, a fruit that grows very successfully in our area. And then we ended the block with a look at the ant, the bee, and the butterfly. The ants we saw, as it were, like the root system of the insect world, with their incredible ability to penetrate even the most intractable parts of the earth, and the way in which they exude formic acid, which, as I told the children, we'll learn about in eighth grade when we learn about human digestion and how we work on the substances of our food. So the ants are like a little digestive system in a certain way. And indeed, they're also the cleaning system, the buildings and grounds people of the earth, taking hold of incredible amounts of waste. And they learned the story of these ants in Africa who will now and then swarm until there are perhaps hundreds of millions of them all gathered together. And when villagers hear that they are heading towards a village, everybody clears out of the village, and they open the doors of their homes to the ants. They let them wander freely through the village, and when they return finally, a day or two later, That village is spick and span and completely sterilized by the digestive acids of those ants. And we learned about the red ants of Texas, a kind of invasive species, but who quite regularly climb up to the top of subgenerators and will actually gather in such numbers that they get electrocuted all at once and they short circuit entire cities and stop the electricity. So when there's a big science project competition to build a huge cyclotron in Mexico, in Texas, it was rejected because of the fear that these ants would get in the works and maybe blow the place up. Then we looked at the bees, who are like the center, the middle ground, the rhythmic contracting and expanding world of the stem and the leaf, and who indeed like to build their nests in the stems, that is the trunk of trees. And we saw their balanced nature and the kind of social harmony, the selflessness, the heart forces of these very remarkable beings. And then we went on and looked at the butterflies. Unlike the ants and the bees, the butterfly is a more solitary sort of creature, a quality of aloofness, a quality of really being connected with the most delicate kind of sensibility, with the light and the air around it, very much like the flower of the plant, as Steiner said, like a liberated flower. And we looked, of course, at its remarkable chrysalis and how it goes through a stage where it seems to completely disappear, where when a chrysalis is opened, all one finds is a sort of quartz-like liquid in there, and its remarkable resurrection out of that. And we ended the block then completely looking for a couple of days at the silkworm. And we had some Japanese children in the class whose parents worked at branches of their corporations in our area. And one mother came in and told us how, as a Japanese Girl Scout, how her project, which is very common, was to tend a group of silkworms, and what it was like, that it's very much like raising a baby, how she would have to get up during the night several times and change them, cleaning the screens in which they were living onto, which were full of excrement, and how the growth was very much like a baby as well, from instar to instar, each larger and larger and larger, until finally that silkworm, which is of course a moth, not a butterfly, weaves its cocoon in the single filament of silk, which can be a mile long. And how we as human beings take this silk and unweave it from the cocoon before the silkworm reaches its maturity. So very few, relatively speaking, silkworms ever turn into moths. But those that do have this incredibly white, white wingspan, whiter than snow, the whitest white one could imagine. Very, very beautiful to look at. And in a way, they permit human beings to cut short this quality of radiant whiteness so that we can gather the silk for ourselves. And what's wonderful about this silk is that of any fiber, of any fabric, it is the most conducive to being dyed. It takes color in the most beautiful way imaginable. And like the moth itself, it has a tremendous affinity for light and air. And as you could see in the drawing that I show in the botany slideshow of student work, As we finish this lesson, the eurythmist was waiting outside the door, dressed in her most beautiful, colorful silks, and she came in and did a few gestures, almost moth-like, for the children. So here is how we ended our block, by moving from the plant pure and simple to the plant on the earth, and finally the plant and its relationship to the animal world. So we see how in the flower there's just the touching of the astral world, enough astrality so that there can be fragrance, so that there can be color, so that there can be the possibility of reproduction. That's where the astral world touches the flower, at the very top, and with it come the insects, who sort of bring, they're like the loftiest aspect of astrality in the animal world. Just something in between the etheric world of the plant and the full animal astral world of the warm-blooded animal. The insect appears in that way. So in a certain way, we are bidding farewell to this wonderful existence of being an etheric, physical human being as a fifth grader. And the head of Janus now is turning towards the realities of earthly life, which will be manifested in their study of mineralogy in grade 6. And so botany ends.